Fangoria presents Class of 79.
Thanks for tuning in to Class of 79 on the Fangoria Podcast Network, where we take you behind the scenes of our favorite movies that turn 40 this year. I'm Natasha Pacetta, your host and vanguard of the vault over here at Fangoria, and this is our series on Phantasm. If you didn't get a chance to check out my interviews with Reggie Bannister and Don Coscarelli, please go back and listen. I totally geeked out talking to them. It was a blast, and I'm really excited for our guest today. He was absolutely integral to bringing Phantasm to life. It's Paul Pepperman. Paul was the producer and special effects creator on the film, and he talks about his UCLA days with Don Coscarelli, figuring out how to make the spheres fly, why they had so many cases of Dosakis on set, getting pulled over on the LA freeway in the CUDA, and how a disembodied finger led to a marriage proposal, and so much more. But before we get to Paul's stories, I want to tell you about Fangoria Magazine. In 1979, the first issue of Fangoria was released into the world. It's been 40 years and Fangoria is better than ever. Each issue bringing you 100 pages of exclusive, carefully curated content honoring horror's past, present, and future. These articles and interviews will never be published online, so the only way to get them is by getting your hands on a physical, collectible copy of your own. We can't give any of the information away about what's in the magazine because we want the experience to be a surprise with each issue, but we can safely say that you will not want to miss a single page. Head on over to Fangoria.com to learn more and to subscribe. And while you're there, make sure you enter the promo code CLASSOF to save 15% off your subscription. Go to Fangoria.com now and subscribe. And I want to tell you about Nightmares Unlimited. Nightmares Unlimited specializes in hardcore props for hardcore fans. Mark Phillips, the owner and creator, is known as the blacksmith of horror, and he makes the most detailed and beautiful props from horror movies like Hellraiser, the Nightmare on Elm Street movies, Phantasm, and more. And in fact, we have two Phantasm spheres in a custom Fangoria Freddy-style glove that he made for us right here in our podcast studio, and they are gorgeous. You can find all of Mark's creations by going to Etsy.com/shop/nightmares unlimited. Mark truly is the blacksmith of horror. Go there now and check out all that he has available. Now, let's get to Paul's stories from the making of Phantasm. So, Paul, you wore many, 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 many hats on Phantasm. But yeah. Let's start at the beginning. So you and Don Coscarelli were roommates at UCLA, and you were actually studying to be an attorney. So how did you get roped into Don's crazy world?
You know, the first day we went to college, and we ended up in the same room, and we started chatting with each other, just, finding out about each other. And he asked me, so what do you plan on being? I said, an attorney. I said, what about you? And he goes, oh, I'm going to be a movie director. I said, okay. Right. And, he took some film classes, appreciation classes. It turned out he was too young. He had to be a junior by state law to get into film school.
Oh.
And he took some acting classes so he could get a better idea of working with actors. And, he just didn't want to wait 2 years before he could actually do more of a hands-on, learning experience. So after the first year, we became very close, living in the same room and just having the same interests. I was a huge movie buff, as was he. And, he talked a lot about, what he was going to be doing. And so after the first year, he decided that he was going to go off and make this movie. And I just got carried along with it. And so, that summer, we started pre-production. And so September of my sophomore year is when we started shooting. And, we started off doing, 2 weeks of shooting with a non-union crew, but they were all professionals. And that just didn't work out very well because we were way behind schedule after 1 week. We were like a week behind after 1 week. I just ended up, even though I stayed registered for another few years at UCLA, we were able to make, two movies together. And I would just, drive down. Of course, eventually we started for budgetary reasons and creative reasons, just shooting on weekends to give us time in between to prepare. So it worked out well. I would just take classes Tuesday through Thursday and then be down staying with him at his parents' house the rest of the time.
Going to college is a good idea for some people. And, you know, others know what they want to do with their lives, you know, and they just start doing it.
When we first filmed the first movie, getting all the equipment there and just looking at it. And I don't know, Orson Welles, when he first went to RKO for Citizen Kane, he said, this is the biggest electric train set a boy could ever wish for. And that's what it was. That's what it was like. It was like, oh my gosh, we're going to learn how to, you know, light the sets and use these cameras and old cameras. We like to use a lot of different cameras for different types of effects, which is just kind of going through the history of Hollywood with, you know, old slow motion cameras and cameras to put on helmets for hang gliding and all kinds of things. And of course, on Phantasm, we kind of graduated to Panavision.
You know, the best way to learn something is to just throw yourself into it. And it really sounds like you guys did it because you completed two feature films before Phantasm. You did Kenny and Company and Jim the World's Greatest. And
actually, on Jim the World's Greatest, after those first 2 weeks of the non-union crew, we ended up firing him. Don and I pretty much learned everything you needed to know about the equipment during those 2 weeks. And then we hired film students and just taught them how to do the sound and how to help with the lighting and load the cameras. And that's pretty much how we did it, through Phantasm. We would hire people and just teach them and oversee all the different crew positions.
That's great. And definitely the best way to learn and the best way to, you know, get other people who are interested in the educational aspect of it and who are interested in your vision, too, to go along instead of just hiring maybe people who aren't invested in what you're doing.
I mean, it was kind of a mix. There were some people who didn't really plan on going into film, but the majority of them wanted to, and it was a great learning experience. And so many of them went on to get into the unions and work on a lot of studio features.
Okay, Paul, let's talk about Angus Scrimm. You actually pitched Angus on the role of the tall man. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, the first movie was at Universal. We had sold it to the second movie, Candy. We sold it to 20th Century Fox. And so we would get screening rooms at the studios and then bring up potential investors from Phantasm to show them a double bill and to be able to show those movies with the Universal logo up front and the Fox logo up front. And so at the time, he wasn't Angus because we hadn't made Phantasm yet.
Right.
But Rory came to one of the double bills with a lot of the, you know, potential investors who were, you know, doctors and dentists and attorneys. And he wanted to bring a couple of friends. And so he was there. And after it ended, I walked over to him and said, Rory, we're working on a new one. And Don's running it now. And he's got a great, great role for you. And you're going to be an alien. He goes, aha, really? Well, let me ask you, what country will I be from? So, no, Rory, you're from another planet. You're out of this world.
Oh, my gosh.
Okay.
Miscommunication there up front. Not from another country.
Yeah.
Completely other planet. Okay, so there's a funny thing with Dos Equis and Phantasm. I know you were probably involved with, you know, reaching out to anyone who could contribute anything, because that's what any producer on a movie does.
Well, this was early days of doing promotional tie-ins. It was kind of the very start of that taking place.
Oh, yeah. So this was like very early. And Dos Equis was one of the sponsors. And you guys just had a ton of Dos Equis around. Tell us about how you guys got that deal, why they decided to give you, you know, free beer.
Well, we had one of our associates was Bob Del Valle, who went on to become involved in many, many TV shows and movies. And he was helping me, and he just went out there and just started putting together a lot of great deals at Dos Equis beer, of course. We had like 24 cases just showed up at our rental house we had that a lot of us were living in at the time for, you know, making the movie. And he got a Fender guitar for the scene with Reggie.
That's right.
And Bill, which Don ended up with. And we had wheels for the Cuda, just lots of fun things. We were just, it was like, you know, Christmas. You get all these freebies. But the Dos Equis was a lot of fun because since, you know, probably like 6-7 of the crew people, including Don and I, were living in this house, you know, during the week after a full day of, you know, pre-production for the following weekend, you know, we'd always, at 5 o'clock, it was Star Trek, rerun time, and we just pull up the beers. And we had this one guy who was with us on three of the movies, and he was a driver and grip, and he would always forget. He would take the Dos Equis, he'd stick them in the freezer in our refrigerator, And we'd go to, you know, hey, where's the beer? Oh, they're in the freezer. We'd open it up. It'd just be this brown slush. The whole top of the freezer was just filled with broken glass and brown slush from freezing the beer. Saying, no, you can't do that. But, it was a lot of fun having the unlimited Mexican beer for us.
Yes, and it's always nice to see. So when you see Dos Equis in the movie, you know that there was a lot of it on the set.
I still order it occasionally for old time's sake.
That's awesome. So like I said in the beginning, you wore an incredible amount of hats on this movie. You are most known for being the producer, but you also were in charge of the special effects.
Can you walk
us through what that process was like? Were you learning as you were going? How did you even tackle the spheres? You
know, Don and I were always learning. On every movie, it was just always a learning experience. And it was part of the fun, was just being able to come across new areas, which we just get educated in. And since it was a great cause, getting the movie done, we were very apt pupils. But the sphere, we found this guy, Will Green, who made turntables for auto shows for cars to revolve around on. And I don't know how we found him and went to his place in Hollywood. He was very mechanically oriented. And we kind of laid out what we wanted. And, you know, we're used to, like, getting quotes from regular Hollywood special effects houses. And he came back to us like a week later. We drove back up there and he presented his plan and we loved it. And he then handed us the bill of what it would cost. And I still have this bill. It's right here on my desk. In fact, I look at it. It was like $1,100 to create the entire mechanical sphere, which was just crazy.
Wow.
And I said, okay. And he did it. And it was wonderful. And it was essentially the sphere that was his creation was kind of like a half sphere, three-quarter sphere. So you could kind of get into it and work the insides of it. And the rest was all camera ready. And so that worked great. But then, of course, that was very limited in its use. So then we had to come up with ways of getting the sphere to, you know, fly down the mausoleum hallways and explode.
Right.
So that was just a lot of experimentation. That's what would take place during the week is, you know, learning how to, you know, get something that was essentially like a big silver Christmas ball,
right,
you know, ornament, and, you know, fill it with red tempura powder paint and hang it from a monofilament and then put a firecracker in it and explode it to make it look like, you know, the shotgun was shooting it, or put it on a piece of monofilament and onto a hook on the corner of the mausoleum walls, and then just throw it in an arc right around the corner, but then film it in slow motion. It would just look perfect. It would just come by. You've seen the movie. It just would slowly creep right around the corner. And then one of the challenging things was having it go right towards somebody, you know, look like they're about to go into them.
Right.
And we finally realized that, part of it was just having someone on the crew who had played, college baseball, you know, take something that looked like a silver sphere and stand over the camera and then just sometimes throw it. And sometimes we throw it and film in reverse so it looked like the sphere is coming right toward the camera. And, you know, as you can see in the film, it was very effective how it worked out.
Oh, yeah, it definitely is. And then it's so cool to know just how you did it because, like, literally – it was a guy throwing it,
yeah,
what you think,
yeah.
And then, you know, playing it back in reverse, like, and if it was, you know, in somebody's head.
Reverse slow-mo, yeah. Worked great.
Yeah. Oh, it's so amazing. It looks beautiful, and it's great to know, like, well, that's kind of just the bare bones way to do it, and it worked.
Yeah, when you're on a budgetary constraint, you just get very, very creative. That's right.
Yes. So how was the interdimensional portal constructed? I know there were some mirror gags involved with that. Can you explain a little bit about how that worked?
Yeah, I mean, Don, of course, you know, had a vision. And a lot of times, you know, when he had his vision, he wanted it to be just like it. So
right.
Once again, we were always challenged, and it was a good challenge to make sure it looked terrific. And so, we found a place that we could, you know, borrow all those barrels from. They're just like, you know, I forget what size drums those were. And we ended up just keeping them around. I don't know why they even wanted them back because we kept them so long. And we cut out some little plastic to put on to make it look like there were windows into it, stacked those up against, inside of, we had a warehouse that we filmed in instead of a soundstage. So we stacked those up. My father was in the metals business, and so he was able to get us a couple of, six cylinders of stainless steel, and he took them to a chroming place, a plating place, and they plated them. So we had those as the two gates, and then it was just a couple of very large mirrors and lots of experimentation, and worked great. I mean, I think people are still to this day amazed that there's no computer generated effects taking place. It's just like a magic trick is all.
I know our audience puts it up there on a pedestal because, you know, it was one of the first movies ever covered in Fangoria magazine. And, you know, we're all about practical effects. And it is one of those movies that, like, look what these guys did with, like, nothing.
Nothing, right.
Made it look so cool and just otherworldly.
One of the great things of working with Don is that, he wanted to always have things look very high quality. And so even though, we had a low budget, because we didn't have a lot of overhead, we could take the time to just shoot and try something different and go back and do it again until we got it just how it would look terrific. And, that's one of the things that we pride ourselves on is that all four movies that I was with Don that we made independently, they all were sold to studios because they looked, like top quality. They didn't look like some, cheap thrown together, weekend movie. They always look very, very professional.
They look fantastic, and the sets are just gorgeous. I know the mausoleum was done in a warehouse, and the actual
same warehouse.
Yeah, same warehouse.
That's right. Yeah.
And the marble is actually just wallpaper that looks like marble, which is incredible.
Exactly.
And some of the other sets are awesome, like Morningside. That was an actual mortuary or funeral home that you guys filmed at, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was kind of local to where Don grew up, and went down there and talked with them, and I don't know, maybe it was a different era. This is back in the 70s, but people were so easygoing about letting a film crew come in, and they just gave us the run of the place. So, we'd come in once again on the weekend, Friday, Saturday, Sunday night, and, the chapel scene, of course, is that's all inside Sunnyside, and just, beautiful, funeral we were able to have take place there. And then the casket room, where, the caretaker comes in and looks around, and Mike hides in one of the caskets.
Right.
That was their casket room. And I remember the actor couldn't get there till, sunrise or something. And so we got through about 3 a.m. and we had a PR to kill. And I should have taken a still of this, but all the crew just, crawled under the different caskets and went to sleep.
No way.
Yeah. That's where they just got a few hours of sleep. And people, they'd be willing in, deceased people, throughout the evening into the embalming room. It's kind of funny. Don and I did a American Cinematheque event a few weeks ago for Phantasm. And afterward, this woman came up to us, and she's one of the morticians at Sunnyside.
What?
And she loves the movie, gave us her business card, and just begged us, please come back when she wants to give us a tour of what it looks like today. So we're definitely going to do that. We can't pass that up.
Oh, that's awesome. It's nice when people are excited about, movies coming in, and they're like, yeah, of course you can use our, building or company. It seems like a little less now with things.
It's much different nowadays, I would guess.
Another thing that was important to you and Don, in addition to making everything look very professional and the highest quality, was the sound design. And I know you guys had like put aside some budget to actually do the sound design at Goldwyn Studios. Can you tell us a little bit about what that experience was like for you guys?
Sure. I mean, well, instead of, like Don and I working on other feature films and seeing all the important aspects of and then finally making a movie, that didn't happen. We just made a feature film
right
off the bat. And so in the first couple movies, it wasn't until we got into the post-production and we could see just how important the whole re-recording process was on the stage, the sound stage. And we didn't really go first class because we didn't know any better and we didn't have the funds. And so when we were going to make Phantasm, since we'd had success with the first two, we learned, all the top places in town, and we just had it that we wanted to go to one of the top places, which of course was, Sammy Goldwyn in Hollywood. So we did put aside money for it, and we reserved a spot, and then we moved into an editing room. And all the editing rooms, this is the old Goldwyn Studios that they shot so many movies back in the 30s and the 40s. And so a lot of the dressing rooms had all been changed into, editing rooms, but they still had, bathrooms and showers. And so we just spent months there editing the movie, and then finally, it was time to start doing the re-recording, and it was just a wonderful experience to have top guys. I mean, for decades after, we would see these guys listed in the credits. And, you know, we came in just after one of the other stages. They'd been fixing for Bunch, The Last Waltz with Scorsese.
Oh, wow.
And we'd hear all these great stories of them. They would just work all night. That's what they didn't do in the daytime. It was all night. Mm. Lots of drugs and lots of celebrities coming by and adding different notes to the concert. But it was a great experience to have that type of quality.
Wow, and it sounds great. In addition to the score, which is so beautiful and probably my favorite score of any horror movie ever. It's my favorite of all time, and it just the sound it just adds to the atmosphere of the film so well. And I think that was just really smart of you guys to go over the top and have that experience where you knew what you didn't want to do anymore and what aspired to do. So yes. I think that is. And another thing that you and Don made sure to do that a lot of people really weren't doing at the time was getting audience feedback on like the rough cuts.
Yes, no, that's true. Since once again, we didn't have a lot of overhead since we weren't paying ourselves. Don would edit and I would sit there assisting and so we could take as much time and try as many different cuts. And, you get so close to it, you start to sometimes lose perspective. And
right.
So it's so important to go out there. And it was difficult sometimes to try and get people to come in and see really what, like a work print of the movie. You wouldn't have all the effects, the color wasn't totally corrected yet, but to get them into a screening room and then just chat with them afterwards, sometimes have them fill out questionnaires about the reaction, and sometimes more like focus groups where we just sit with them and talk and see what worked and didn't work. And a lot of it was really just sitting there and feeling what was going on, because you could see them jump and hear the reaction, and or if not, if there wasn't the right reaction, you knew you had to trim things and change some of the sound effects to make them do a little bit of a scare. So it was very, very helpful.
Do you remember the first time that you showed it to an audience? Do you remember the general reaction that they had the very first time?
The best time was it opened on Times Square in New York.
Mm.
And I actually was on my honeymoon down in New Orleans going on a cruise. But I surprised my wife. She'd never been to New York before. So I surprised her. We went to the airport and flew to Manhattan.
Oh, fun.
And Don and Angus were there all ready for the opening. And so we spent like a few days just traveling around and, going to different theaters. And the opening night in Times Square at the Warner Theater, it was just fantastic. It was a full house. I remember some people right in front of us, the guy jumped in one spot and he had a whole bucket of popcorn and went flying. It just couldn't have played any better. We were so excited, and that was. And actually, there was another screening. This wasn't before it opened, but it was in Hollywood, on Hollywood Boulevard. And I was in bed one night, and Don called and said, okay, you got to get over here. The movie started at midnight. At this point, it's like 12:15. So it's playing great. So I jumped in the car and drove down there, went in and found him off to the side somewhere. And it was just amazing. It's just so much fun to go in and see the results of all your hard work, how it would pay off.
Oh, yeah. Oh, definitely. That must have been such a cool moment, both of those times. And that's funny you mentioned you're on your honeymoon, because you actually met your wife on the set of Phantasm. Can you tell us
that's
about
right.
that?
That's right. Yes. I hired her to be a camera assistant. And it's like everyone else, they were people willing to be taught. So I sent her to Panavision for a couple of days to get schooled in how to, clean the Panavision, the Panaflex camera, and load it and load magazines. So she did that, but she also was an art major at UCLA, and so she knew how to use gel tray, dental gel tray, for doing body molding and stuff.
Mm.
And so she would sit with me in the middle of the night and use my fingers to mold what ended up becoming like the moving finger in the box.
Oh, yeah.
In the movie. And so through all those middle of the night, sitting there just waiting for things to dry with my hand, we got very close and started dating, and ended up getting married. And we ended up walking down the aisle to the theme from Phantasm.
Wow.
And Angus was there. Angus didn't perform the ceremony, but Angus was there.
Oh, what a nice story to come out of such a creepy movie.
And it's 40-year anniversary next month.
Oh, wow.
Of our marriage.
Congrats.
Thank
wow.
you.
Wow, that is amazing. I love that. So as a producer of this movie, producers always get the craziest jobs. You're always doing, you know, just insane things on the spot that you have to do to get the movie done. Do you remember, does anything stick out in your mind that was just super insane that you remember having to do on Phantasm?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, it's pretty much every day.
Every day, yeah.
Yeah, just dealing with, you know, personalities and, you know, people are always tired because we're, you know, long, long hours, but so nerves get frayed. I'll tell you one thing, it wasn't really something crazy, but I remember one time we were changing locations in the middle of the night, and I said, I'll take the CUDA and get it where it's going. So I took the CUDA, and I think I stopped off at my parents' house and got some dirty clothes picked. I don't know what I was doing with dirty clothes in my front seat. I guess I was going to go there later, so I was in the front seat. I had the cardboard phony Oregon license plates on the CUDA, and then the shotgun in the back seat, and I'm on the freeway in Los Angeles. And I don't know why the highway patrol pulled me over, but they did.
Oh, no.
And, of course, there's no registration because so many people would drive the car. I don't know where the registration was. It wasn't in the glove compartment. And pretty much they started just – all these cars started appearing, all these other highway patrol, and there were, like, four cars. I think just having, you know, like a laugh, like, oh, look at this guy. Funny license plates.
Oh, my
gosh. A gun
in
the back seat, dirty clothes, no registration. And finally, and I told them what was happening. It's like, yeah, they're going to believe me. And finally, they just said, no, I think it was not worth their time to have to write it all up. They said, get out of here, go.
Wow, that is crazy.
But you know what? It's like, you know, Don and I, it was really our lives because, you know, everyone else are going back during the week. They're either going to school or to their jobs. And we didn't go anyplace other than just continue working on the movie 7 days a week.
Right.
And so, you know, it's like we would have done anything. That's just the most important thing is our lives at that point. So it's not a matter of just any crazy thing that would have come up, we would have done. Because in our minds, and you really do lose perspective, and we were young and very, very passionate, but you would do anything you had to do, no matter what, pretty much, to make sure that you get the shot and stay on schedule and get the thing finished. So it was both Don and I. It wasn't really just being a producer. I think we were both just crazed about making sure it was as good as possible and nothing was going to stand in our way.
And that's passion right there. It really is. And it shows in the movie. It really does. It's a masterpiece. And you can see all of the hard work that went into it. And I know I certainly, you know, I watch it and I appreciate all the aspects because I know to some degree what it takes to get something done or just will something into existence. And that's what you guys did with Phantasm.
Yeah.
And,
yeah,
you know, it's spawned four other movies in the franchise. And
yeah,
it's been 40 years. And did you ever think that people would still be so enthralled with Phantasm after four decades?
Never occurred to us. I mean, we were so excited, you know, when it came out, and we, of course, thought it was great, and a lot of people did. But I don't know, I guess at that age, you're kind of looking towards the next thing and just never think about growing old. I mean, I can't imagine we ever thought what it would be like 40 years down the line, because that's like, you know, ancient. Now I look at I'm 40 years married, but like we would have thought about people talking about the movie 40 years later. And thank goodness they are, because it makes us so happy, and we get such a kick out of just, you know, every 5-10 years, there's more milestones and there's, you know, new DVDs. It's just fun, you know, touching base with everybody and just interacting with all the fans.
I have one more question for you, Paul.
Okay.
And it is the Class of 79 extra credit question. And that is, what advice would you give yourself 40 years ago, either on the set of Phantasm or just in general?
Wow. You know, I'd like to say it would have been nice to somehow, you know, slow down and savor and enjoy everything that was going on. But you just can't do that. I mean,
yeah.
Don and I were making decisions every 3 minutes. Something had to be decided. Something had to be done. We were always in a rush. There was a sun about to set. We had to, you've got like just your golden moment to get that. You know, I guess my advice would be to people, if it was me, is to take chances. I mean, you know, thank goodness I took a leap of faith to not worry about school and to get involved with Don and his family. And they were just amazing. And it's just been great, working with Don and being best buddies, 40 some years later.
Wow. Yeah, that's great. I think that's advice that everyone listening to this should definitely take. Take a chance and see what happens. I mean, you could make the next, beloved horror movie.
That's right.
Thanks for listening to Fangoria Presents Class of 79. We really appreciate you tuning in. And if you've enjoyed this podcast, we'd love it if you would rate, review, and subscribe on iTunes or on your favorite podcast app. And follow Fangoria on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram for the horror content you crave. Class of 79 is a Fangoria Podcast Network original, produced and hosted by Natasha Pacetta, executive producers Dallas Saunier and Phil Nobile Jr., associate producer Jessica Safavamare, art and design by Ashley Detmering, sound recording, design, and mixing by Natasha Pacetta, music by James Malone, for Fangoria, Brandon Wynerdy, Jason Koslerich, Rachel Wilson, and special thanks to Udo Kier.